From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. When psychotherapist Salvador Minuchin began working with delinquent children in the 1950s, he discovered that the problems belong not just with the child, but with the whole family. Coming up, we talk with Minuchin about his pioneering work in family therapy. How I Became Hetty Jones is a new memoir of life in New York's literary bohemia of the 50s and 60s. It's also a portrait of the interracial marriage between the former Hetty Cohn and the poet and playwright Leroy Jones, who later changed his name to Amiri Baraka. Coming up, a talk with Hetty Jones. Also, classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz considers recordings that bring together classical and popular music, and Mark Halliday reads a new poem. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Dale Willman. A major figure in the Pentagon procurement scandal of the 1980s pleaded guilty today to bribing a former assistant Navy secretary to help an Israeli company obtain a contract. Defense consultant William Galvin also admitted participating in a scheme to bribe Deputy Assistant Air Force Secretary Victor Cohen to help another defense firm obtain a radar detection contract. Galvin, who pleaded guilty to conspiracy, bribery, and tax evasion, could be sentenced to up to 40 years in prison and fined up to $1 million. Customs officials in London said today they foiled an attempt to supply Iraq with 40 American-made devices for triggering nuclear weapons. Officials say they arrested five people after an 18-month investigation by U.S. and British authorities. The probe ended today when an attempt was made to put the devices on board an Iraqi Airways flight to Baghdad. The French government today announced a total ban on cigarette advertising and imposed tighter restrictions on the promotion of alcoholic beverages. From Paris, Lynn Terry reports.
These measures are part of the government's campaign to curb cigarette smoking and cut down on the consumption of alcohol. If approved, as expected by the parliament in spring, the measures will even prohibit tobacco companies from sponsoring sporting events starting in 1993. Besides that, the government's plans would increase the price of cigarettes by 15% next year. The government also said regulations would be introduced to make it more difficult for adolescents under 16 to buy alcoholic beverages. It also plans to restrict advertising of alcohol to magazines and newspapers. Now these ads are shown on television and in movie theaters. Scientists say 100,000 French people die prematurely every year from overconsumption of alcohol. They also say the death toll from cigarette smoking could rise dramatically in the next 30 years if people don't quit. For National Public Radio, this is Lynn Terry in Paris.
The State Department today praised a new agreement reached in Nicaragua which calls for the Sandinista government to relinquish control over the military. NPR's Richard Gonzalez reports.
The Sandinistas agreed in writing yesterday to subject the Nicaraguan military to civilian control. The new ministers of defense and interior will be named by President-elect Chamorro. However, the military command structure, which is dominated by Sandinistas, will remain intact. This agreement follows another pact signed late last week in which the Contras based in Honduras agreed to drop their weapons by April 20th under the supervision of the United Nations. Here's the State Department's Margaret Tutwiler.
The United States supports the agreement reached last week to demobilize the resistance. As Ambassador Wilkinson made clear at the Security Council yesterday, however, many operational details must still be fitted into the framework now established by the UN.
Among the details that need to be worked out is how the Contras inside Nicaragua will be disarmed. I'm Richard Gonzalez in Washington.
On Wall Street, prices closed mixed today. The Dow Jones Industrial Average rose almost 7 points. This is NPR. A report released today by the General Accounting Office says makers and distributors of lawn care pesticides are making false and misleading safety claims that could harm users' health. The report also says that federal agencies bring few enforcement actions against the pesticide industry. The report was released at a hearing of the Senate Environment and Public Works Subcommittee on Lawn Chemicals. In Israel's self-declared security zone in southern Lebanon, a massive hunt is underway for three masked gunmen who killed an American missionary last night. William Robinson, a 56-year-old former U.S. Marine from Chicago, had lived in Lebanon for 7 years. Mike Theodulu reports.
Israeli soldiers have raided houses and made a number of arrests in Rosh Hayafuka, where William Robinson was shot dead last night. But it's likely his killers fled the area immediately after the attack. Two left-wing Lebanese nationalist guerrilla groups have claimed responsibility. He had been executed, they said, because he was planning to plant Jewish settlers in southern Lebanon. But Robinson's killers weren't about plain robbery. After tying up his wife, they made off with her jewelry and $4,000 in cash. Recently, there have been a series of vitriolic attacks in the local press accusing Robinson of trying to buy up land in Rashaya to build houses for 200 Jews from the United States and Sudan. Israel says it had nothing to do with Robinson or his plans, but it hotly denied rumors it intended to settle Jews in southern Lebanon. Robinson's colleagues say he was planning to build an old people's home there. For National Public Radio, I'm Mike Theodulu in Nicosia.
Military officials in the Philippines say government troops destroyed a heavily fortified communist rebel training camp after 2 days of fierce fighting. The battle left 59 insurgents and one soldier dead. Officials say the camp was discovered on Sunday in a remote region about 540 miles southeast of Manila. The rebels were armed with U.S.-made weapons. A published report today says Japan may contribute its advanced technologies to projects designed to improve U.S. military weaponry. That report says Washington and Tokyo have agreed to conduct joint research to be used in future American weapons. This is NPR. I'm Dale Willman.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Dr. Salvador Mnuchin is one of the founders of family therapy. His specialty is working with troubled adolescents. Mnuchin started practicing family therapy in the 1950s when he worked at a reform school for delinquent boys. By the 1970s, he had become known for his aggressive style, which provoked family members into confrontations that dramatized their problems. Mnuchin says he's toned down his approach as he's gotten older, but his focus has widened. He now views families in their political and social context, and when necessary, he's spoken out for reform in the juvenile justice, mental health, and welfare systems. During his career, Mnuchin has worked with both poor and middle-class families. Salvador Mnuchin grew up in Argentina, the son of Russian-Jewish immigrants. He emigrated to Israel in the 1940s, then moved to the U.S., He's semi-retired now and lives in New York, where he's the director of Family Studies Incorporated and a professor of research in psychiatry at NYU. He has a new book called Institutionalizing Madness. I asked Dr. Mnuchin why it's important to see the whole family instead of treating an individual alone.
When we see the total family, we don't see only Oedipus. But we see Oedipus father, we see Oedipus mother. We don't see the relationship between the child and the mother, but we see in what way the relationship between the child and the mother is organized by the distance between the father and the mother and things of that sort. So it is just common sense. It is something that my grandparents knew. It is something that religious people know, that they work with families because they are a unit.
One of the things that you've become known for is pioneering almost confrontational techniques in your therapy with families. Can you give us an example of a confrontation like that you've tried that you think is effective?
I started working in the 60s with families in Harlem. I was a psychiatrist at Wiltwick School for Delinquent Children. And I was working with families of the slums. And in these families, what we were noticing is sometimes the kind of affect would go from lack of response to a large intensity of response. Middle ranges were difficult to elicit. And so frequently I found myself that I needed to introduce, to provoke, to lend affect, to create, to break apathy, to break the lack of energy in families that had been depowered by social systems that intrude on them. And so I developed a technique of creating unbalance, of creating stress, of putting people vis-a-vis each other and asking them to talk in ways that they didn't talk, so that I develop a rep that I was confrontational, mostly because people in the field tend to to be kind of bland. You know, the idea of challenging, I would not say that I was confrontational. What I was is challenging. I am still challenging. I think that the way in which families, family members deal with each other become routine, and there are rules that constrain novelty. And so these rules need to be challenged. And so I would challenge.
Well, let's see if I can get an example. For instance, I've read about how sometimes working with anorectic families, with a family in which a teenager had stopped eating, you'd say to the parents, force your child to eat.
And in situations like that, what I used to do is to create conflicts between parents and children as a way of moving the anorectic person away from her concentration in the obsessive relationship with food and more toward a me-you kind of relationship that that I felt was necessary for her, because usually it is a woman, for her to begin to be involved. I was breaking the patterns of functioning. So I did say to parents, don't talk with her. She needs to eat. You need to save her. You will not let her die. These were very seriously ill patients. And it is your function that she should eat. That was a confrontational technique that was related to the idea of empowering parents, of saying to parents that they have hopes and that they have a function in the healing. Now, that is something that is generic to family therapy. The idea that the family members have a function in the healing of people, and that and the introduction of hope. Families come to you, you see, with a sense of depletion. They had worked for hours, months, year in problems that are insoluble. And in the end, when they come to you, kind of they are like a caricature of themselves. They are narrow. They are narrow in the sense that they believe that there is only one way of doing things. And one of the things that the family therapist does in a variety of ways, sometimes confrontational, sometimes being friendly, sometimes being seductive, sometimes all kind of ways, sometimes being cognitive, teaching, and so on. But what you try is to elicit options to expand the way in which the family members see themselves. In effect, what you are doing is expanding their history. You see, families come, family members share a history, a story. And the family therapist said, I will help you to construct a story about your life that is more complex than the story that you tell each other.
Now, let me ask you, say you were doing a one-on-one psychiatry, and your client was the daughter, you know, the young woman who had stopped eating, and you were trying to deal with this problem. Do you think you wouldn't have been able to get at how manipulative she was of the family? Do you think that the psychiatrist always takes the side and empathizes with the client and doesn't necessarily see ways that they're abusing other people?
The story that the patient tells is the story that the therapist works with. The story that the family therapist experience and sees is much more complex than the story that the individual therapist experience. Because you begin to see the same story from a different perspective. It is, you see how the story of the daughter and the story that the mother has and the story that the father has respond in certain ways to the same kind of roots, and nonetheless are in a way modifying each other, interfering, supporting. One of the things that family therapists think is that while one member is expressing a symptom, the rest of the family, in some way or other, is involved supporting that symptom, organizing that symptom, modifying the symptom, that the family functions very much in ways that that all the family members are suffering because there is one symptomatic patient. And one therapist, Carl Whitaker, a family therapist, says that he uses the metaphor of the knight in the chess game, and he says there is the black knight that is the one that carries the symptom, the symptomatic member, that is constrained, but the white knight is equally constrained in its movements, though it's not labeled, so that in some way he equates all family members as being restricted.
Let's take a short break, and then we'll talk some more about your approach to family therapy. And my guest is Salvador Mnuchin, and he's a pioneer in the field of family therapy. He's the director of Family Studies Incorporated in New York, a professor of psychiatry at the University of Pennsylvania, and a professor of research in psychiatry at NYU. He's the author of several books. His new book is called Institutionalizing Madness. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and distributed by National Public Radio.
My guest is Salvador Mnuchin, a pioneer in the field of family therapy. Do you think understanding behavior, understanding a problem, helps you change it?
No. I know that this is, the answer should have been yes, but I don't think so. If that would be so, we would just need to read books.
That's right.
You know, and then we will all be very wise. No, and actually I think very few people in the field think that understanding a problem changes it. You know, we are very much constrained by an experience that is much more complex than just understanding or lack of understanding of a phenomenon.
Then what does change behavior?
Relationships. Let me say, for instance, you have an... I am interviewing a couple.
Mm-hmm.
And the man says certain things. And he says, well, because you know, blah, 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 blah. That kind of tone of voice. And he... And you see the wife being afraid. She makes gestures of becoming smaller and smaller. Now, at the same time, but she doesn't say anything. Well, in situations like that, the man thinks that what he said is the content of what he said. But what I hear is that the woman's response, it's not to the content, but to the manner in which he said that. And then one can challenge the man. One can ask him, do you know what you had done recently? Do you know why she doesn't answer? Well, she's always withholding. She's always not responding to me. Do you know that you do not allow people to answer to you? That kind of direct observation of phenomena that people do not know. Or, for instance, you can say to the wife, you need to answer. And you put them in a situation that they usually don't have. Because the usual situation is, he says, and she escapes. Then he goes after her. She escapes. And that is the transaction. Now, you do not allow that to happen. And you do not intervene. You just intervene by saying, please, talk with him. And then something completely new occurs. Something that does not occur in the usual transactions in the family. So that what you are beginning to work is with what I used to call the structure of the family. Issues of proximity, issues of distance, the ways in which in families people enter into coalitions against other members, things of that sort. You begin to change the way in which people relate with each other.
In your new book, Institutionalizing Madness, you write that therapy that focuses on the family in isolation is in danger of serving an ideology that values families but resists taking political measures and resists dealing with social factors that overtax families. In other words, that if you're just looking at a family and you're not looking at other political and economic and social factors that are making family life hard, you're not really looking at the full picture.
That's correct. I think that in 1964, I think, or something like that, we wrote a book called Families of the Slums. When I read this book now, for instance, I am impressed that this book was considered a pioneering book in family therapy, was an extremely naive book from a political point of view. Because at no point did we challenge the judicial system, for instance, the way in which the judicial system impacted in the life of these families. We were working with welfare families, and at no point did we challenge the way in which the welfare system depowers these families, the way in which the social institutions that work with the poor create a situation that maintains these people in a depowered position.
You've worked with both middle-class families and with poor families. What are some of the basic differences, if there are any, in the types of techniques you would use to approach both?
Well, there is one basic difference, and it is that the poor family, if we continue with the metaphor of the story of poor families is written not by themselves. The story of poor families is written by social institutions that intrude on the families, creating a sense of lack of control over their own destiny. Middle-class families have the illusion, but in effect that's true, that they have the way of controlling their destiny, much more certainly than the poor family. So that when you work with poor families, you really need to work at ways of empowering. The position then of the therapist is, it's a difficult one because one needs to help in such a way that doesn't depower. Now, that's not a problem when you're working with middle-class families. You can challenge without thinking that you are depowering or destroying. With poor families, the main emphasis is in eliciting their strength. And they have a lot of strength.
Dr. Salvador Mnuchin is my guest, and he's a pioneer in the field of family therapy. He's the author of many books, including the new book, Institutionalizing Madness. If you don't mind, I'd like to ask you a question that I'm sure is quite unanswerable, but I'll ask it anyways. Why is it that so many families are so neurotic? I mean, you know, most people believe that the family unit is the best option that people have, and yet so many families fall apart, and even in so many families that stay together, there are these terribly self-destructive, neurotic relationships that go on. I mean, it seems to almost be typical as opposed to atypical.
Well, you see, I don't see it that way. I see families are very, very, very complex social organisms. And in general, you know, people live the best way that they can. And when I see families, I see them not as neurotic, but as families that sometimes get stuck in a process of evolvement. Families that were working okay up to a point, but then a change occurs in their life. A child goes to college, somebody gets sick. And so then they continue working with the old patterns instead of changing when circumstances change. So that the function of the therapist is help them to become a more complex organism. You know, I think that your question is related to a misunderstanding of what families are. You know, there is not such a thing as the family without conflict. That means that's not the nature of the animal. The nature of the animal is that two people that come from different families at some point join together and they need to learn to create a new culture, in which their own children will grow up and become adults. And this is a very complex phenomenon, and people need to accommodate, need to share, need to accept the other people's point of view. It's tremendously complex. I think it's less boring that way. So I don't call that neurotic. You know, I think that forever and ever, the families will be rather imperfect social organisms. And there is nothing wrong with it. That's what we have.
Do you think that you've been able to use your expertise as a family therapist in your life as a father?
You should ask that question to my children. They are the only ones that can answer that.
Well, I figure there's almost a danger, I figure, in being the family expert in your family.
No, because you can't. You can't be an expert in your own family. You really, in your own family, you are the same kind of bumbling, fumbling father that other people's are.
Okay. Dr. Mnuchin, thank you so much.
Fine. Thank you.
Salvador Mnuchin is the director of Family Studies Incorporated and a professor of research in psychiatry at NYU. His new book is Institutionalizing Madness. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Next time, writer Paul Monette. His new book is a semi-autobiographical novel about testing positive for the AIDS virus. I hope you can join us.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from Talbots, retailers of women's classic clothing and accessories through stores and catalogs, 1-800-225-8200. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Coming up, classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz gives a listen to some recordings where classical and popular music combine. The latest example is this recording of Cole Porter songs performed by Stephen Grappelli and Yo-Yo Ma. The poet and playwright Amiri Baraka devoted part of his recent memoir to his first marriage, an interracial marriage with Hetty Cohn. Now she tells some of the same stories from her perspective in the new memoir, How I Became Hetty Jones. Coming up, we talk with Hetty Jones. And poet Mark Halliday reads a new poem. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. British Prime Minister Thatcher had a 50-minute telephone conversation with Soviet leader Gorbachev today, in which she appealed to him to exercise restraint in Lithuania. Jonathan Dyer has more on the story.
Mrs. Thatcher is apparently the first Western leader to talk with President Gorbachev about Lithuania since the Republic declared independence on March the 11th. British officials said Mrs. Thatcher's objective was to get negotiations going locally and, quote, to keep the temperature down. The initial purpose of the call was to enable the two leaders to talk before Mrs. Thatcher meets West Germany's Chancellor Kohl on Friday. But, an aide said, they covered the world scene and naturally the discussion turned to Lithuania. The official declined to comment on Gorbachev's response, but he said there was no dissatisfaction on Mrs. Thatcher's part. In Lithuania, the Republic's president, Vytautas Landsbergis, has said that the situation is still dangerous despite the present calm. He said that the Soviet authorities might provoke unrest in order to justify further military intervention. I'm Jonathan Dyer in London.
West German Chancellor Kohl said today that the first elections for a parliament of a unified Germany will most probably be held in the second half of next year. Earlier, Kohl had turned down suggestions that West German elections this December be expanded. 1 year ago today, the Parliament of Yugoslavia approved amendments which incorporated the semi-independent province of Kosovo into Serbia. This move touched off street rioting in which dozens of ethnic Albanians were killed. Today, ethnic Albanians marked the first anniversary of the rioting with peaceful protest. Pierre Vickery has more.
Tanks and armored personnel carriers patrolled the streets. Helicopters and Air Force jets flew overhead in a massive show of strength by the Yugoslav armed forces. But despite the presence of hundreds of mainly Serbian riot police, the ethnic Albanian population staged an impressive demonstration of their own. Factories closed down for 2 hours, many people stayed off the streets, and children, some dressed all in black, either boycotted school altogether or staged silent classroom protests. But the Serbian minority in Kosovo used the declared public holiday to reinforce their opposition to any political compromise. For National Public Radio, this is Pierre Vickery in Zagreb.
According to Financial World magazine, Maryland comes in first among the states when it comes to financial management. The magazine rated the various states on how they balance their budgets, predict revenue accurately, and use generally accepted accounting principles. West Virginia comes in last on the list. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials closed up almost 7 points to close at 2,743.69. This is NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. Classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz says that like classical performers themselves, a classical music critic doesn't necessarily love only classical music. Lloyd has a review of some recordings in which classical and popular musicians join forces. He says it doesn't always work, but when it does, the results can be memorable.
A recent CBS album called Anything Goes, Stefan Grappelli and Yo-Yo Ma play mostly Cole Porter, raises again that nagging issue, the difficulty of cultural exchange between the worlds of pop and classical music. How few opera singers there are, for instance, who can sing pop songs without condescension or without making them sound bloated. And how few pop musicians can bring off a classical piece. Barbra Streisand once recorded an album of classical art songs, But instead of bringing new energy to these leader, she tried so hard to be proper, the songs ended up sounding merely square. MCA has recently issued on compact disc an old Decca album of the late Yasha Heifetz playing popular selections from Stephen Foster to Kurt Weill. After a luscious violin arrangement of White Christmas, the tables are turned and Heifetz accompanies Bing Crosby in a couple of concert songs. Crosby over-sentimentalizes the lullaby from Benjamin Godard's Jocelyn. But I think his laid-back crooning actually generates an odd intensity in Hermann Lohr's gypsy song, Where My Caravan Has Rested.
Where my caravan has rested, flowers I leave you on the grass. All the flowers of love and memory, you will find them when you pass.
Sometimes the crossover is inspired. Think of the piccolo trumpet solo by George Mason of the New Philharmonia Orchestra on the Beatles' Penny Lane. Paul McCartney had heard Mason playing Bach's Second Brandenburg Concerto on a BBC TV show and decided a trumpet was just what his song needed. The trumpet solo was the last thing he added. Mason sounds like a cornetist in an old-time band concert. He conveys both a celebratory dazzle and a deep nostalgia for more innocent days. One of my favorite mixtures of classical and pop is the appearance of the Hollywood String Quartet on one of Frank Sinatra's best albums, Close to You, which was recorded in 1956.
I think of you with every breath I take, and every breath becomes a sigh.
Despite its name, the Hollywood String Quartet may be the greatest chamber ensemble produced in America. Its first violinist, Felix Slatkin, and cellist, Eleanor Ahler, are the parents of Leonard Slatkin, the conductor of the St. Louis Symphony. In Nelson Riddle's sensitive arrangements, the quartet reflects the earthy sweetness of Sinatra's youthful voice and the touching intimacy of his phrasing. With Every Breath I Take by Robin and Ranger, takes on an emotional complexity chamber musicians and leader singers should all envy. I wonder what Sinatra could have done with Schubert. Yo-Yo Ma's Schubert is already legendary, but on his Cole Porter album with Grappelli, it's remarkable how much character he can get his cello to inject into the fairly conventional jazz arrangements. Ma is a musical chameleon. His jazz playing seems as completely convincing as his classical, teasing but elegant, never trivializing. To Yo-Yo Ma, fun can be a serious business and still remain fun. That's probably why his playing is so easy to love.
Yo-Yo Ma does Cole Porter. Lloyd Schwartz is classical music editor for the Boston Phoenix. This is Fresh Air. Hedy Cole. Hedy Cohn met Leroy Jones in 1957. She was a white bohemian working on a small jazz magazine. He was a black writer, soon to establish an international reputation for his poems and plays. Cohn and Jones married, had two children, and published a literary journal together from their kitchen table. But a few years after Hedy Cohn became Hedy Jones, Leroy Jones became Amiri Baraka, a name that better fit his new identity as a black revolutionary. The marriage ended in 1964. Hedy Jones raised their two children and wrote several books for adolescents. Her new book is a memoir called How I Became Hedy Jones. Baraka published his memoir, The Autobiography of Leroy Jones, in 1984. I asked Hedy Jones what it was like to read about herself in his book.
It was a strange experience, let's put it like that, since he changed my name in the book and he purported to write a factual book, but indeed he changed the names of myself and a number of other people who were central to that whole movement or scene or whatever you want to call it in the arts. And so finding myself referred to as Nelly in his book was a strange experience. And of course, when someone doesn't set out particularly to write the story of one person, there are, of course, lapses. And I don't think he set out to write a story of a marriage or a particular... He had a different point of view, let's put it that way. And so for me, it was an odd experience.
Do you know why he changed your name from Hedy to Nelly in his autobiography?
Nope. I guess you'll have to ask him.
Okay. In your memoir, you write about the day that you and Leroy Jones married, and you write, "I was the happiest and best-loved woman in New York." Now, I went back to Amiri Baraka's autobiography, and he writes about the relationship. "We seemed to get on smoothly enough, though there was no great passion. We got married, and still there was no great passion." And I was wondering what you think about hearing this both ways. You know what I mean? Like hearing this kind of aloofness in Baraka's book and then, you know, thinking about the way you experienced it. Do you think that he was being a revisionist about his own emotions or that you both experienced the thing very, very differently?
Well, I think maybe the revisionist might be the word to describe that, because, well, it was a long time, and everyone has a right to be a revisionist, I suppose. Well, people do it all the time. I mean, people rewrite history all the time in the light of what they know later. But I think that if you read the poems that he wrote, I think they explain how he felt then much more than the book that he wrote 20 years later describes how he felt then. You can't write such beautiful poems without feeling a little passion, and it didn't seem that way at the time. We had a very non-argumentative kind of marriage. We didn't have loud fights and disagreements. We didn't get on like that. We got on very peacefully, and we had a lot of fun.
Mm-hmm. Your husband was having affairs with other women. Did you feel it would have been too middle class to call him on that? Did you feel that somehow you had to accept it?
Well, no, I didn't feel that I had to accept it. I just got a little tired of dealing with it, and my way of dealing with it wasn't to insist, although I did, if you recall from reading the book, I did insist once that he was making a fool of himself. I didn't say get out. I just told him that he was really looking awkward, and he was looking like that stud, that the stereotypical stud, and I thought that he should look at himself for that reason. But if you hook up with a man who's a womanizer, I think you, or at that time, you have some choices. You can call him on it and tell him that he's got to stop and pay a great deal of attention to it, or you can just say, okay, this is what he's doing. But if I follow his every movement, then I have much less time to follow the movements of my own life. And we did have the kind of marriage in which we were mutually interdependent, but I always felt that I was an independent person. And so the more time I spent looking after his affairs and trying to find out who he was with or trying to trace him down, the less time there would have been for me to conduct my own life. And I was really trying to do that.
After you were married, Leroy Jones's writing started becoming more militant and more separatist. And you say that reviewers would always point out that he had a white wife. Now, how is that supposed to be interpreted? Was that supposed to somehow make him a hypocrite?
Right, exactly. You can't, you know, as they say, talk black and sleep white. When it got really bad, there were people who would call up and say, you're laying with the devil. I think this is a narrow attitude on the part of many people who feel that black militancy is a thing unto itself that white people cannot, in a way, lend themselves to or participate in some way. I think we have to understand, especially on the part of a white person who is in a marriage to a black person and who has become the parent of black children, that there's no going back. You can't be thought of as simply a white person who is, quote, on the other side. There are many many colors of black, and in a way, we have to understand that in the world to come, there are going to be many colors of white. There are ways to look at a white person and not see white, and look at a black person and not see race. We have to learn, I think, in this country, to begin to see ourselves as American. That's my goal, anyway, if that answers the question.
Well, yeah, and as a matter of fact, I want to get back to that in a minute. I just want to get back to what we were talking about, though, with the reviews that mentioned, you know, that Jones is married to a white woman. How did he take that? Did he start to resent you when it was implied that somehow he was being hypocritical because he was married to you?
Well, of course, it sets up an imbalance. You know, you have to explain yourself all the time, and that was, he wasn't taken on his literary merit, or even for what he said. He was taken on his personal life. That is, his work came down to his domestic affairs, and any person who writes is going to resent that a little bit.
You have two children.
That's right.
Both Leroy Jones and Mary Baraka is the father of both. And you had basically talked about before you had children that in an interracial marriage, a child of an interracial marriage is always going to be seen as black.
Mm-hmm.
So when you divorced, you were a white woman with two children who would be seen by the world as black. This was in a time of increasing black nationalism and separatism. Did you start to feel that you and therefore your children were going to be cut out of certain black circles that you had been a part of before?
Well, certainly it was a difficult time, and there's no denying that it was. But Leroy Jones and Mary Baraka's parents were very fond of their grandchildren. We'd always had a very good relationship, and I was estranged from my family. And so I really was far more a part of their family by that time. They did not repudiate the children. And when it came down to situations in which I knew my face was not welcome, I sent the children alone. There were other situations in which the children appeared without me, taken to certain events by Baraka and his second family, or taken by other sympathetic black friends who knew the situation, knew the political polls at hand, and who saw that Kelly and Lisa Jones needed to establish their roots in the black community and establish themselves as young black people who were going to always be part of a black revolutionary movement. And so they needed to, no matter who their mother was, they needed to be in on certain things, and so they were taken along. And I understood, I mean, you have to have one thing, when you enter into a marriage like this, and when if a person decides to have black children, you got to realize that there are going to be risks involved. There are going to be things that may be difficult, more difficult than an ordinary marriage where this issue doesn't arise. And so if you want to consider that self-sacrifice, then I suppose it might be. But I just did what I had to do.
You talked before about there being different shades of white. And how does that apply to you as someone who has a mixed family?
Well, now that things have come around a little bit, you know, we went through that particular hard time that we just talked about, and then things sort of, there was a new wave of interracial bohemia in the later 70s, and I got to know a whole generation of young black and white and Asian people, and who established a multiracial and multicultural bohemia, and I do see myself as part of a multicultural, multiracial reality, which I really think is the reality of the world, and much more of what the America of the future will look like. And I've always been a person not to look at the past, but to look at the future.
Hetty Jones. Her new book is a memoir called How I Became Hetty Jones. This is Fresh Air. Let's see what's coming up on All Things Considered. Robert Siegel's with us. Hi, Robert.
Hello, Terry. We'll be hearing today about the arrest of two Iraqis in Britain. They're charged with trying to smuggle nuclear detonators out of Britain to their own country. Also, news from Nicaragua about the outlook for the Sandinistas in opposition and the news that President Violeta Chamorro will have control over the country's armed forces. And another talk with Vytautas Landsbergis. He's the president of Lithuania, and we talk with him a bit about the situation in his country where psychological pressure is still being applied by the Soviets.
Thanks, Robert. That and more coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Mark Halliday is with us again to read a couple of poems. The first is about a season gone by.
Summer Perdu. Was there a white house with black shutters just off Grove Street that in summer was surrounded by scarlet roses? Did you walk past it on a hot day, wearing your sky blue t-shirt with a patch that said Donati's Gulf Service, on your way to the Corral restaurant looking for your big brother Billy? Was he there, eating a sausage grinder? Did he laugh at you in a way you instantly forgave? Did Billy drive a blue Jeep whose seats felt wonderfully high up? And when Billy was off somewhere, did you sit on one of the revolutionary cannons in the park with some girl named Julie, near the statue of some tall green man? Was it Julie or another kid with whom you spent a week or at least a day saying, "Wugga, wugga, wugga," your secret message derived from a Tarzan movie? Did that happen? And do you now wish you knew who that green statue was of? And do you now find those scarlet roses bedecking one dark space in your head and softly buzzing. This next poem, called Springtime for You, comes out of the feeling that you can never completely know the inside quality of another person's life. So what I did in this poem was use the word you in a way that keeps shifting. Springtime for you. You had an experience. It was the night you and Zara saw Divorce Italian Style at Cinematheque. You both sipped lemonade. Zara's eyes were dark with her thinking about her father. I can tell you remember it. Judy sat in the dappled shade of the mimosas and myrtles, watching you play tennis, and laughed like music when you tripped over your racket. It was the morning after the call came from Kentucky. Later, her arm brushed against your arm in sunlight, and Jim Friedman drove you back to campus. I'm sure it meant something to you, the way the car was blue and Death of a Salesman lay on the floor. A cooling wind came off the nearest mountain, and what you felt was not romantic love, but something more interesting. That's what you thought. Jim talked about Churchill and Roosevelt while you studied photographs by somebody, not Walker Evans, but a woman, those wooden walls and faces, those textures of seriousness, as you said to yourself. It was that night. When Tommy's father played a record by Peggy Lee, of all people, you said something that was just right. Springtime. And you are the one who was there.
Mark Halliday's collection of poems, Little Star, is published by William Morrow. Amy Salad and Phyllis Myers produce the interviews on Fresh Air. Our research assistants are Lou Jean DeJoseph and Rich Banowitz. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, by this and other NPR member stations, and by grants from the National Endowment for the Arts and Talbots, retailers of women's classic clothing and accessories through stores and catalogs, 1-800-225-8200. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, guest host Marty Moss Cohen talks with Paul Monette about his new novel, Afterlife. It explores how three men deal with the grief of losing a lover from AIDS. Also, animator Paul Feerlinger discusses his animated documentary, And Then I'll Stop. The film is considered the first of its kind to deal with alcoholism. That and more on the next Fresh Air.